I'm Chris Benda, Theological Librarian at Vanderbilt University's Divinity Library, and I'd like to welcome you to another in a series of conversations about recently published or forthcoming books by faculty in Vanderbilt University's Divinity School and Graduate Department of Religion. Today I'll be talking with Bonnie Miller McLemore, E. Rhodes and Leona B. Carpenter Professor of Pastoral Theology and Counseling, about the Wiley-Blackwell Companion to Practical Theology, which she edited and for which she provided an introduction. Bonnie, thank you for being willing to do an interview with me.
Thank you. I'm glad to do it.
Great. Now, I wanted to start with sort of a general question about practical theology. The book, as the title makes fairly clear, is about practical theology, and it attempts to answer the question, you know, what is practical theology? And rather than at this point rehearsing how you do this in the book, I wanted to talk about the terms practical theology and maybe what we can get out of those terms in terms of what practical theology is all about. So we have the word practical, which, you know, conjures up to me things like praxis, practice, something opposed to a theoretical approach to theology. And then theology itself, I mean, is a huge concept, but, you know, reasoning about God, discourse about God. What do these terms tell us about what practical theology is?
It might be helpful to say something general about the book and then turn to your question.
Okay, sure.
I was approached by an editor at Blackwell at the time, and now Wiley-Blackwell, because they do these companion series, and they're really focused on disciplinary areas that not necessarily narrowly defined, but they have a variety of disciplines that they've covered. Postmodern theology would be an example of somewhat of a discipline, but not religious ethics, Christian ethics. They have companions to a variety of different kinds of scholarly bodies. And when I was approached, I think they were probably themselves not sure what the disciplinary area that they wanted covered when they invited me. And there, you know, especially a British, it's a British press, and in a British context, pastoral and practical theology are somewhat, or a little bit more interchangeable than they are in the U.S. context. And my sense, even though I teach in religion, psychology, and culture, which has underneath it pastoral theology oriented towards pastoral care and counseling in a variety of different religious and secular contexts, I felt that it really would be best to do a companion in practical theology, which is a broader, more encompassing field, not even a discipline, but definitely even a broader field of study. So that's one thing even about the title and the subject matter. The term practical theology, it has such a complicated history that, you know, I could give a really long answer to this. I will say that since the 1950s and 60s, there's been growing movements, plural, across, and maybe even there were foreshadowings of this in the prior century, across the religious and theological studies in rethinking how we study and understand theology. And some of that sparked by liberation movements, clearly. Some of it sparked by what was happening in other disciplines outside theology, like anthropology and sociology, and work being done in ethnography and how you might study cultures and religious communities. And so there, I think you can trace across, really in the last 50 years, an intensity around interests in rethinking and redefining where and how theology happens, occurs, takes shape, is formed, is articulated, is embodied, etc. And so it's a problem to have a phrase practical theology because it misleads the reader or the audience to think that somehow there's a juxtaposition, like theology isn't practical, so then you have to put practical in front of it. Or, as some, you know, people tease, as if there's, is there abstract theology or is there, and in fact, I think that's one of the criticism of some of these movements is, in fact, there have been rather obtuse, abstract, and removed theologies that have not really attended to the radical dissonance between proclamation and reflection on proclamation and deep systematic philosophical exploration of theoretical claims and religious actualities, theological actualities. So maybe there is, you know, something that's abstract theology. I think practical theology does hope to put at the forefront a real curiosity about this complex interaction between confession or belief systems or cognition around thinking about God and its appearance in communities and individual practice and lives. And that has been what's been exciting in the discipline as it's developed in the last two or three decades, is trying to determine ever more interesting, creative ways to get at that piece of the wider study of religion and theology. I mean, of course, another way to answer this question, too, is that some of it, especially in my context and my own academic formation, goes all the way back to a Protestant history and a Protestant German European history in which Friedrich Schleiermacher is often, you know, identified with, but he's not the only one who began to try to, you know, categorize the different parts of the study of theology in the university, in part to make a case for its place in the university. And the U.S. in particular, but also Europe and other countries, have lived out the beauty of that articulation and the problems of that articulation. And some of that has been around serious issues around the intersection of practice and theory, both in theological education for ministry and seminaries and for academic reflection on the study of religion. So you could also trace those terms to that history. It'd be another place I would think those words are coming. But I do think, in general, certainly in my own work and research, but I would say that I would want to argue that it's true for other colleagues that are, you know, in this broad field of so-called practical theology, that I think as a general rule, we do have an interest in kind of shaking up the conventional ways that theology has been, you know, conceived and taught and understood across a variety of locations in the last couple centuries. Increasingly, and I mean, I'm not the only one making this comment in the last 50 years, but sort of a sense of there has been this feeling of making it less of an elite intellectual, theology that is, exercise, and trying to open it up to a variety of settings and locations and voices. And I think practical theology as a discipline, narrowly defined, has benefited from those plural places that kind of a reassessment of theology has been occurring. And it's been occurring in the midst of the most conventional, systematic theological study as well. I mean, I see a lot of systematic theologians interested in some of these same questions. A lot of crossover there. And not just with systematic theology, but certainly with some other disciplines. Religious ethics would be another example. Sometimes I think that what I do in some respects is not that different. It is still, but from some of these other disciplines that also have had a renewed interest in practice in the last, you know, 20 to 30 years.
I will ask this on the assumption that there is the possibility that you do what you do now, but wouldn't be a practical theologian. So how did you become a practical theologian? I mean, how did this way of looking at the work that you do appeal to you or become part of how you do things?
That I love this question, because part of me, or maybe the whole of me, wants to. I'm not I wonder if I were to self-identify, if I would self-identify as a practical theologian. I have colleagues who would, and there are PhD programs around the country in practical theology. And I've gotten emails from students, you know, what is a, do you have PhD students that have dissertations in practical theology? And I'm a little stumped by that because it's such a broad field. Mm. And in fact, I think the companion really depicts that. And it's almost like the medical field. And usually people in the medical field would self-identify as a nurse, nurse practitioner, med tech, a physician. And I think I tend to self-identify. My deepest interest and the way I got into this area was through a couple more narrow disciplines that were deeply interested in human behavior, well-being, healing, suffering, and those were the disciplines of psychology and religious studies. So my graduate degree, my undergraduate was in psychology and religion, and then, I mean, kind of a minor. I didn't get a major, double major, but could have. And then I went on. In retrospect, it looks like it all makes sense, but at the time it really didn't. I just happened to find a top-flight graduate school that had a top-flight program called Religion and Psychological Studies. And I mostly still feel most at home in that disciplinary area. It does include within it an interest in pastoral care and theology and counseling, but it's a bit broader than that. And if I had to pick what I wanted to teach or what I wanted to read, I tend to be more interested in that smaller piece of the bigger pie. And if I were to get enthused about my vocational publications, I kind of look at the companion as something done with deep desire to contribute to the discipline. But it wouldn't be my most exciting, publication. It really did feel to be the right thing at the right time to meet a really important need. And in fact, when I was talking about this with doctoral students at Princeton at a meeting this weekend, it was wonderful to hear a student say, oh, I love this companion. I mean, it's going to be so helpful to me. Hmm. Even though it is more of an encyclopedic or dictionary or, overview or depiction of a field writ large. So that was really gratifying. I probably get more enthused when somebody expresses deep gratitude for work I've done on women in religion or children's lives in religion. And for different reasons, those are more books that exemplify the kind of theology that practical theology is trying to sustain and support. They're not really books. Well, they are books in practical theology, but I'm not so sure I would explicitly describe them. And that genre is so broad. So that's kind of my story I was deeply shaped by the study at University of Chicago, because even while there was an experimental new program in doctoral studies in practical theology that I was influenced by, and my primary faculty advisor, Don Browning, was a major leader in trying to build up academic infrastructure for the sustaining of practical theology as a discipline. So the International Academy of Practical Theology and the U.S. Association of Practical Theology, he lent a lot of intellectual support. And I also have done some of that in terms of both the national and international conversation, including getting a place for practical theology at the American Academy of Religion. It was a little bit difficult there because, again, how does theology, broadly speaking, fit into the American Academy of Religion? There's not much question about that, but there have been tensions and debate and really interesting discussion about, the study of theology and its place in the Academy of Religion. And, of course, practical theology is even more identified with confessional, congregational commitments, but as a discipline, it's not necessarily any more restricted than any other scholarly area, even though that is the, you know, impetus original, the initial impression that students have. In fact, the conversation I just had at Emory with their graduate students in their religious practice program got right to that question of the place of faith confession and religious studies. And what was interesting is for me to say, you don't really escape that question no matter where you are in a postmodern curriculum, no matter what discipline. So all of you out there that are doing ethnography and thinking you're doing it as a religious studies scholar, bring interesting values and your own formation in a variety of maybe diverse contexts that are affected by religious traditions. And those are shaping, you know, there. And of course, practical theologians are more explicit, I think, I'm digressing here, about their desire to be transformative towards their own religious values and convictions. I think that's one major difference. Mm-hmm. But in any case, I sort of do identify as a practical theologian, and I sort of don't. Mm-hmm. And we have discussions about that here with some of my colleagues who might be more self-identify as a practical theologian. Yeah, it's a great question.
Before we get into the into discussing the different portions of the book, I wanted to just ask sort of a administrative question in terms of how you decided who was going to be writing for this book. I mean, you do address this in the book, so I was just wondering if you would talk a little bit about how, you know, who are the contributors and why them and not somebody else.
That's helpful to. That was a fun part of this book. Mm. I actually had a colleague in another discipline surprised when I told him that I had 56 authors. There are that many? And in fact, there are not only that many, but it was really hard about where do I draw the line in terms of who in the discipline should participate in this volume. And there's always regrets and persons that didn't participate that I wish had, etc. But I think I was aiming. There are some very senior scholars who I did not include, and in fact I think I say in the introduction that there are only a couple of retired emeriti faculty who contributed, and that was primarily because I knew they could address a particular topical area and as perhaps the best spokesperson for that area. So I went for I wanted senior scholars, but senior scholars who had another, maybe reflecting my own position, another 10 years of influence. And there was a significant amount of, and that's, I think, was a compliment to the growing interest in the discipline and its growing strength, is that there were a lot of viable names. Mm. And so that's the biggest pool. And then there are a few younger scholars. I haven't gone back through the contributor list to count, but a couple are probably pre-tenure. They're in the minority. And those are persons who I'm fairly convinced are going to continue to have a significant voice and place in forming some of the discussion. So so that was there. Unlike some of the other companions, I also had a real sense of the international discussion that's been occurring around the field, broadly defined. And that was complicated because a lot of the other companions don't attend to what's happening beyond the European U.S. conversation. And then again, how do you be in a limited volume global? So it's definitely not global, and I ended up picking what I maybe for better or worse use the phrase hotspots, places where at least in an academic context practical theology has flourished. And those are, I think I noted more in an American Academy of Religion panel on this book, that sometimes those are also places where wealth gravitates. So there's, you know, some interesting and problematic issues. But nonetheless, so that some of the authors, in selecting authors, I was looking internationally of who could help me represent different parts of the world. to my gratification, I think this was, you know, subconscious, but it's always there for me, are issues around diversity. And that's really difficult for a variety of reasons to achieve in a volume like this. And part of it, it just reflects back the ongoing discriminatory nature of academic intellectual interchange. But one reviewer that I read of the companion didn't really go back and make a final count, but said this is one of the few volumes where the gender, there's an incredible gender equity. So there's, you know, I think almost 50-50 in terms of men and women participating. And again, some effort around race diversity, which reflects, you know, the some of the failures of this field to continue to cultivate a variety of diverse voices. And so I think there are really growing edges around representative voices. But so I kind of that's kind of the description of the diversity. But I would say that I also, as I began to think of topical areas, there was kind of an interplay of going back and forth between this person should be in the volume regardless of what they write, and then here's a topic area that needs to be covered. I need somebody to cover it, and okay, that's another way that the authors evolved. Maybe one of the first things I did, even before I had a conceptual framework for the four parts, was just try to get a list of, you know, no matter what they write, these are some folks that really should contribute. I think if I went back through my old file, I would find that as one of the first things I did. And, you know, for that, I just began to take, membership lists of different academic societies and conversations with, you know, people in different realms to sort of hear what, you know, is there somebody I'm forgetting and that kind of thing.
This isn't an administrative question. It's more of a question about, there are a number of concepts that run through the book. They don't necessarily appear in every chapter. They're central, I assume, to the discipline of practical theology. And you've already mentioned Schleiermacher, and he shows up a few times. One of the ones I wanted to ask you about, though, was this concept of the living human document. And there's also the concept, which I think is yours, of the living human web that kind of builds on that. What do those concepts mean, and how do they come out of this practical theology discourse?
Yeah, that's such an interesting observation. For me, really, it's a little surprising. And I'm actually pleased, but it makes me want to go back and sort of notice that, what you've picked up, and see where it's happening in the volume. I wouldn't have expected it exactly. I do think that as a disciplinary area, both nationally and then internationally, for better or for worse, it's that living human document goes back to William James, Anton Boyzin, and Seward Hiltner in the U.S. And it's for better or for worse, I say, because in the history of the U.S., Anton Boyzin is more claimed in the pastoral care and theology circles as a founder or as someone who's very influential. But it's interesting, if you look at some of the British history, they also, of practical / pastoral, they also identify Boyzin as important. I think he was important in coining that term, and I think a colleague at Princeton, Robert Dykstra, has linked his use of it to his reading of William James. But I think what Boyzin was doing was insisting that, and this was more formation of ministers, and probably very narrowly focused around, you know, what we would say as mainline Protestant ministers, but pretty convicted that that kind of theological education should not be happening in an institution removed from encounter with religious practice. And so he's the one who coined the term that of the study of living human documents as a part of his work in the clinic, in the hospital context. And he's also identified as someone who really contributed to the growing institutionalization of clinical pastoral education, which still functions as a field site for seminaries across the U.S. And it was Seward Hiltner then who had the academic chutzpah, because he had the, you know, position in an intellectual university, to begin to then make a case for this as an important part of scholarly study. And so, you know, between Boysen and Hiltner, it sort of became a fixture. I think it's a good way to again, try to locate where theology is being studied and encountered and reflected upon. And that's why it's had staying power. It's interesting, though, as just recently I began, you know, to think about even that term document and its textual and verbal and linear reads, and a need for there are some interesting sort of modern, postmodern reflection on that. And in the meantime, when I started teaching, which was in the 80s, I did coin the term living human web, but it was only because I was being representative, descriptive, and trying to illustrate what I was seeing when asked by the Christian Century to do one of the essays that they were inviting people from a variety of disciplines to kind of write for the Century, a popular, you know, or scholarly but popular magazine, on the state of your discipline. Mm-hmm. And that really was a shift that I encountered both as in my own academic movement from graduate study in the early 80s to teaching in the late 80s, that the document was extremely limiting, that it seemed to isolate and locate issues that needed to be studied in a broader contextual way, not just in terms of person in culture, but also in terms of the way in which politics and economics and social biases and powers and structures shape individual suffering and pathology. So I began, you know, I kind of coined it, but it really did fit what was happening, but in terms of variety of scholarship in the discipline and of wider interest in studying the complicated relationship between, you know, self and society, or person and culture. And there still is ongoing need to think about that complexity. You know, I just heard a paper by a colleague at Princeton about the need to continue to sustain a real focus on the inner, by which he meant the important value of psychology in the study of self-suffering. So the pastoral theology kind of lives with that. And I think the final, an update article I did, mm-hmm. tried to say that actually this maybe isn't a very helpful metaphor, but we need to understand the human document within the living human web, and that their inner relationship, mm-hmm. is what is challenging to comprehend. And that there are gifts in both realms, or interesting foci in both realms. Mm-hmm. But it's fun to hear that ran across the book.
I don't really know much about this field at all. I mean, this was a book where I learned quite a lot. So to encounter those terms that I hadn't seen before kind of sensitized me, I think, a little bit to seeing them pop up here and there again. So, yeah, I mean,
And it's interesting with Living Human Web, because in this more recent article that I did, I tried to parse out, it's one of these metaphors that has the dangerous problem of being used as if we're talking about the same thing, but we're talking about that, we're using that term for a variety of different. So in that article, I talk about, some people seem to be just using it to talk about the interconnectedness of, you know, church and seminary, or theology and the sciences, or the multiple disciplines within theological education. Other people, myself included, use it as a kind of political term to talk, maybe, you know, simplistically about how the personal is shaped by the political, and the need to attend to both, and certainly the political, and thinking about so-called personal, mm-hmm. struggles and suffering. But so it's a little bit of a fluid metaphor. More so, web is more so than document, and I think It has got and that may be why it makes its way across the volume, is people are using it. They're really using it in a variety of different ways.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, speaking of the volume, I wanted to turn to talking about the various sections, the four sections in the volume, and just, you know, it's a huge volume, and there's no way that we could possibly cover everything that goes on in each section, so I just wanted to give the listeners sort of a taste of what they will find in each section. You mentioned in the introduction to the book that as you were somewhere along the line, you realized, oh, there are, you know, these four distinct enterprises that can be packaged under the practical theology term, which you identified and then which track through the or feature as the titles for the sections. Practical theology as a way of life, practical theology as method, practical theology as curricular area, and practical theology as discipline. So I thought we'd kind of look at each one of those sections. When I was coming up with questions for this interview, I toyed with the idea of starting off as you sort of start off in the book, which is with practical theology as way of life. What you're doing in this section is, you know, you're talking about practical theology or practical theology or theology as an activity of faith, and you have there are chapters on eating, on suffering, healing, loving, various other kinds of things like this. What are you doing when you're talking about practical theology as an activity of faith? I mean, what does that mean, and why did you start the book this way?
Yes. Let me start with what I'm doing a bit and then go to the structure of the book and why I start there. As I hear you say those, eating, mm-hmm. Suffering, healing, consuming, or I forget how.
Yeah, consuming, right.
Right away I hear this gerund, this ing, and I play with that a little bit in the introduction, because a gerund is kind of a noun that functions as a verb, which is really nicely said, that's a nice depiction of practical theology's interest. It's really interested in the activity of what we think of as subjects or nouns and how they're acting, what they're looking like as they're being enacted. And so right away you start the book with, what does it look like to think of theology as a gerund, as something being enacted? And it's to get to the question of why start there, it's a really unusual place to start, particularly in a companion series that is mostly focused on disciplinary infrastructure. Most of the companions would not do that kind of. In fact, there's one exception, and that's the Christian Ethic, Companion to Christian Ethics that Stanley Hauerwas did. And I think he has got a whole nother reason for being committed to, you know, upsetting the conventions in intellectual engagement of ethics. But we're kind of unusual in starting a volume that's on a companion to a discipline with this kind of on the ground reflective engagement of theologies that's embodied. But it's precisely, it's refreshing to start there instead of with part four, which is, part four is on the discipline. And 10 or 15 years ago, or maybe even if some other editor had done it, that might have been the whole book and seen to be adequate for the task. I think in some ways it was making a statement to just compelling the reader and the scholarship to think, this is, if you don't have meaning for theology in this sort of everyday, daily particular as a discipline, then the field is not serving its ultimate purpose. The whole volume itself was significantly shaped by a couple of different projects that I've been involved with, both at our doctoral program here. We've been funded by Lilly to do a curriculum in theology and practice that I was significantly involved in developing as a grant, planning grant, and then a full grant. And at the same time, I was involved in a conversation that, again, Lilly funded of a about 20-some scholars and ministers from across a variety of disciplines. It was called Practical Theology and Christian Ministry. And both of them had a real impact on my trying to figure out, so what is practical theology? It was in that context that I began to see that we use that term in a variety of different ways, and it was even just simply descriptively helpful to begin to distinguish that sometimes we're just talking about practical theology in religious communities that people are embodying, but sometimes we're talking about a discipline, and those are really different things. Mm-hmm. The discipline studies and benefits and is for the enrichment of the activity of faith. But anyway, it was in that context that I began to have this sense of definitional need or desire to kind of get some clarity around definition. And it was probably in conversation with one of the lead persons in that second consultation, which is Dorothy Bass. She's done a lot of work on practicing faith practices, formation in religious traditions. And it, I probably should credit a conversation with her that was like, oh, that's right. Why put that, I think at one of my outlines probably went to her and several others for feedback. So I kind of had, I think I call in the introduction a virtual, maybe I don't in that writing, something else I've written. I try to credit this virtual committee that didn't know they were consulting. But they did at times explicitly give me feedback on the table of contents. And I think it was in an email or verbal exchange with Dorothy that I had that part one at the end. Mm. And it may have been Dorothy who said, why is that at the end? And it was like, oh my gosh, it's kind of you're exactly right. It shouldn't be at the end. Mm. And I will, and one other thing I'll say about part one, authors who wrote for part one had a particular challenge. In most cases, they had never really written such a piece. And this is hard to, I mean, the persons who were writing for the part four, maybe that's true for all the parts, but I think there were particular challenges for people who were writing for part one because I asked them both to kind of show practical theology in action, but also articulate how it fit into a disciplinary conception of practical theology. And, you know, some do that more and less. Some have more interest in practical theology as a, quote, academic discipline who wrote for that section, and some not, you know, more so or less so. So they had to kind of do something a little different as they, and also that section is even more than any other section. I mean, they all have places because it ended up becoming more of a, what's the right word? I don't like the word encyclopedia, but so all of the sections you can feel as if why isn't this here and why isn't this here? But the part one was most explicitly of all the parts meant to be illustrative. Mm-hmm. I did try to pick what seemed to be significant places of activity of faith. But on the other hand, that's relatively endless of where you might want to focus. And I also wanted to benefit from people that I knew could write for different types of... and I actually had one person who couldn't participate, and I can't remember what the ING was for that particular person. But, you know, so, that's not a comprehensive section. It's more of a flavor of giving flavor of variety of flavors of practical theology.
So this particular kind of, or way of thinking about practical theology, unfortunately we just have to skip from one section to the next. Let me just make sure that I, the second section, I mean, again, we could say lots of things about each one of these sections, but the second section was, is entitled Method, Studying Theology and Practice in Library and Field. And you note yourself in the introduction that actually this section is comprised of chapters that focus on method and others that seem to be more theoretical. And you can even see that in the chapter titles, case study method or quantitative method, and then the other ones, psychological theory, feminist theory. So I wonder if you could talk a little bit about what the difference is between method and theory. And then I personally was having some difficulty thinking about practical theology as method, because I was kind of connecting it with work in my past, which is in biblical studies. Biblical studies uses a lot of these theories and a lot of these methods, obviously not all of them. But I wouldn't consider biblical studies a method or think of it as a method. So am I just thinking about things strangely here? Or is there something specific about practical theology that lends you to call it more of a method?
I really like that. It'll spark ongoing thought for me as a way of pushing that question. That is the contrast that you're drawing between a disciplinary field, or, you know, however biblical studies would understand itself, field or discipline, and practical theology. Because that's been one of the complicated dimensions of its recent scholarly history. And you can find 1980s scholarship where there's actually almost the inverse of your question, by which I mean people like Roman Catholic scholar Bernard Lee, and he's not the only one, but he's a good example. He has a few articles that he wrote where he actually really does say practical theology, I may be overstating his claim, but he's not alone. Practical theology isn't a discipline. It is a method. Hmm. And why would he and others say that and even still say that? In part because they were seeing it, and rightly so, as invested in reconnecting theory and practice, that there had been a divergence across the curriculum. And they saw practical theology as a method for doing research and writing that did some of that reconnective, reconstituting work that needed to be done in a variety of places across the scholarly curriculum. And so for the 1980s, one of the most important contributions, well, maybe not the most important, but an important contribution was to take something that was already operative in hermeneutics for a long time, I mean, even back to Schleiermacher, and then certainly revise and change dramatically in liberation theory. But to take the hermeneutical circle and really begin to try to use it to do, I don't really like this term, but cross-disciplinary work, but work that moves from a problem, an issue, a practice, to theoretical tradition, engagement, scriptures, back to a revised engagement of practice, back to a revised portrait of the tradition and the claims of a faith community. And this kind of circular, including in it, of course, from the liberation hermeneutical circle, the sense of importance of social, political, contextual analysis. So in the 80s, that is how the term often functioned. And you can find a lot of literature where that's really at the heart. And then there's even recent books where that seems to still be the heart. So Richard Osmer has an Introduction to Practical Theology, and it's mostly about, it is more practical theology as a method if you look at his book. And so that's why that section is there. Maybe I should say something about the book's overall flow and where I put what. So it moves from activity of faith or religious practice, part one. Part two seemed, kind of an inverse triangle, but, you know, that's the broadest use of the term activity of faith. The next broadest use is this practical theology as method. Why? Because it gets, at least in theological education, maybe less so in religious studies in the university, but practical theology's method gets used across the disciplines to sort of study theology and practice. So there are ways in which different places in the academic curriculum of theological education has to engage practical theological methods to understand what theology looks like in practice. Mm-hmm. So that section is probably intended to be most useful to people in a variety of locations across the theological education curriculum. Mm. And it represents a variety of sites where people have tried to think about how do you study theology in practice. I mean, that's oversimplified. And it starts with case study, in fact, because if you go back to Anton Boyzen and the Living Human Document, that really evolved in a clinical setting, deeply influenced. We have parallels in medicine and law in the interest of case study material. And then the section goes all the way to more current interest in things like practice theory, theory of practice, which gets me to your question about method and theory. You know, in some ways that hit me from the side in that I didn't notice explicitly the kind of tension in that section between those two different terms and their use. And some of the chapters are very much around steps to study. They can be employed. They can be put into practice. They are method chapters. They really, you could take them and think about how am I going to go study a religious community, and whether it's through ritual theory or through case study or through ethnography or qualitative or quantitative method. You know, so there are chapters like that. There are other chapters that are more, and they have theory in the title, and in some ways they give the broader infrastructure for how you might study a particular community, person, or context. Feminist theory would be an example, or womanist theory. They have implications for the study of practice, but they really don't provide step-by-step methods of how you might go about engaging in the study of practice. And it was somewhat in one of the authors actually broaches this, Sally Brown's chapter on hermeneutical theory, because there's been a debate even in hermeneutics whether it's a method or a theory. So she actually was the one where that's some of the issue that I'm seeing as I'm reading these chapters and trying to understand as an editor. And the other place I see it discussed with different terminology is John Swinton and Moat have a book on qualitative research and practical theology. And what they do is they make a distinction between the term methodology and method. And when they use the term methodology, they really mean the theory of method. And then the method is actually how you do it. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I have still been thinking about that. I do think one of the growing questions I'm having, maybe it's not going to be that relevant or interesting to the discipline, but the discipline is really worried about this term practice and what is it and how do we find it? What are the various meanings that are even used when we're using that term? But I think that there's still a need in the academic discipline to think about theory and, you know, what is that? And how does it function? And so forth. But that's on my mind. Not maybe as a cutting edge issue, but just of interest. I think there's literature outside theology and religion discipline around that kind of question that I'm interested in looking at, thinking more about.
Right. So, it's an example that this book is not the definitive statement on practical theology, that there's, even within it, there are these contrasts and debates going on, even in this chapter, as to what exactly practical theology is as a method or theory.
You know, that is one of the absolute first things I think I said at the AAR panel on this volume, is what a sense of what's the right... humility, I don't know if humility is too strong of a term, but this is just a temporary marking place. You know, just, and there are a lot of, it does make a statement, but certainly an invitational statement for revision. Mm. And that's part of the problem when I began to tilt towards a volume that was more, it looks like it could be an attempt to be exhaustive or something in definition of a discipline. But it's interesting, I didn't get to say this, but I did, some of the other companions, if you look at them, the general format is, instead of 50-some chapters, 35 very long chapters, 8,000 words, which is hard to translate for a book, but it's longer chapters. And I chose against that because I thought that from where we are currently, we didn't need one more volume where experts in the field wrote about their very favorite academic subject, but it wouldn't have much interest to the diverse communities that might benefit from some of the scholarship in practical theology. And so that's why I tilted back towards this type of volume. And I could see there have been volumes that have asked, you know, stars in the discipline to write about what their work is. And those are important. It just wasn't what I thought was needed when I, you know, began to toy with it. But, you know, what a humbling position. I'm like, you're kind of conceiving a discipline if you're doing a companion. And I honestly wasn't so sure I wanted that responsibility. At the same time, I felt in a nice place to be able to try to offer it. And I had a lot of colleague input. I tried to. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I'm kind of moving towards what it ended up being. But yeah, it's definitely to be revised. Yeah, I think that may be true for all the companions to a certain extent, but this one makes that more obvious. Yeah.
Well, heading sort of down the, you talked about the broadest being the first, and then we moved into the methods. The next section, I guess, narrower in this conception is the focus on the curriculum, educating for ministry and faith in classroom, congregation, and community. And you talk about not you, but the folks who write these chapters talk about the various disciplines. I said sub-disciplines, but they're disciplines that fit under this umbrella term of practical theology, like pastoral care, homiletics, religious education. But you also have chapters on biblical theology, systematic theology, ethics. I mean, how do they? And you kind of alluded to this earlier, but how? How do they relate to practical theology? I mean, you know, would the systematic theologian out there know what to do with being placed in this book?
Right. Well, a couple things about this part. One is, for certain persons, this is really true internationally. I had a colleague in South Africa who was unclear, why isn't this part part two or part one? And it is true if you say practical theology in theological education, I'm talking here divinity schools and seminaries, often their instant association, particularly in some schools more than others, so it'd be less true at Vanderbilt and some of the other places I've been academically, but they instantly think of this corner of the curriculum, the arts of ministry, the practical theological disciplines. So that's why, even though some persons, when they hear practical, that's what they think, I do think it's a narrower than part one or part two, in that religious studies doctoral students or faculty or others could be interested in the method part two, but mostly part three will be people who are in theological education. And the complexity that you have there falls right where you were saying, oh wait, these are disciplines, but I said sub-disciplines. Well, we do have this tension and dilemma that if you're teaching in a theological curriculum, you hope to have a broader shared aim, because the curriculum should hang together as a whole for the divinity students who are participating in it. And practical theology has been really invested in thinking about, so what are some of those broader aims that cross over our disciplines and make us sub-disciplines as part of a broader whole? Even if the whole, and this is so true of Vanderbilt, is incredibly diverse and the aims are multiple. You know, it's very true here. And so even though we have tended to think of the narrowly practical theologies as disciplines in preaching or pastoral care, worship and religious education and mission, etc., this definition of practical theology asks all the disciplines to think toward that broader curricular intent. And what are you doing teaching biblical studies in such a context, and what might be some of the issues that you need to think about? And, you know, although those scholars of biblical studies really might not understand or want to realize that they are engaging in some form of practical theology, they by necessity are asked to do so because they're forming often students for a variety of ministries, not necessarily just congregation. And some of the curricular components require that they think towards these broader questions. So in our curriculum, for example, we have a senior project, and those ministry students in the MDiv program have to do some kind of project that has a practical theological relevance for ministry. And so biblical faculty scholars have to understand that and help students use scriptural resources constructively toward that end. And that's actually probably one of the biggest challenges for ministry students, is to go from a course in scripture to doing a senior project that doesn't go back to what they came with, which is a confessional employment of scripture to make a case, when in fact they've been in, you know, a degree program precisely to help them enrich and deepen the way in which scripture is engaged. So initially I think I was going to just have, you know, the 6 or 8 or however, what some schools, not this one I'm really glad, call Area 4 disciplines. You know, so you've got biblical, systematic, historical, and over here you have Area 4. I've never been in that kind of context. I've been free of that, both at University of Chicago, my first teaching appointment, and then here we don't have that kind of division of our labor. I'm really grateful. But initially I was going to just have the so-called Area 4 or the so-called practical disciplines, and then I, you know, realize, no, this question or this demand that is part 3 puts pressure on everyone in the curriculum. Chapters are written at different levels. You know, some people really attended to that, other people less so. Certainly if you're in ethics or systematic, that's not your biggest question is not how to understand what practical theology has contributed to the curriculum. But, you know, people in those chapters were asked to think kind of about, both to talk about their disciplinary area, and what it does toward this broader question of practical theological engagement. Mm-hmm. And some of them did it by reflecting on their sub-discipline, and some of them did it, interestingly, by reflecting on how they teach and what they teach and why they teach it. And it was fun to see the different ways in which scholars engage this kind of dialectical or inner curricular conversation toward the wider aims of theological education, you know, to the extent that they engaged it and how, in what ways.
Mm-hmm. Well, we've come to the, I don't know what it is, it's not the bottom, but
yeah, the most narrow
portion of
which
the book.
Some of my colleagues would go, that's not evident.
Well, that's, and that section I think was one of the longer.
Yeah, it's a pretty sprawling section.
And that's the one on discipline, which we've been talking about throughout this conversation in various ways. And this section, it's entitled Discipline, Defining History and Context in Guild and Global Setting. And it's actually divided into three, the section's divided into three parts. There's there are essays on various issues with which many disciplines have had to deal. For example, there is an essay on race, an essay on gender, an essay on economics, and some other, various other topics. And then they're all treated from the perspective of practical theology. Then there are essays on practical theology as a discipline and how it's developed globally. And then there's a section where how it's developed in various religious traditions. And I wonder if we could just talk a little bit about... any of these things is huge. So I was going to propose that we talk about practical theology developing as a discipline, which you've already kind of done to some degree. So I'm wondering if instead we could talk about what kinds of challenges you see for practical theology as a discipline within a global context, since that is one of the emphases of this book. You could go all over the place with this, but what kinds of things do you see focusing on practical theology as a discipline?
That's, yes, I like going to this topic because I can talk about it sort of through a paradigmatic example, if that makes sense.
Sure.
I've been a member of the International Academy of Practical Theology now for a couple decade plus at least, and, That's sort of a fledgling institution that was created probably early 90s, and partly with an awareness that there is a need to really make an academic, intellectual, scholarly place internationally. But not unexpectedly, that emerged in European and U.S. context, number one. And it also emerged in heavily... just to describe sort of white male leadership. There were some women involved, but, you know, it was German, Netherlands, and these were the places where the discipline was really being interrogated and fought for in university settings, really an important achievement. And so that achievement still needs to be sustained. It needs to be, and it is hard if it's a practical discipline, because we're studying the complexity of practice and interdisciplinary in work, and sometimes it can lose its important intellectual infrastructure and the work that needs to be done. So that continues to be a really important aim to sustain really strong scholarship. And I mean, I can't underscore that enough. But right from the beginning, there were many of us who have been in historically for centuries, you know, marginalized from participating in intellectual productivity, and who were part of this conversation from the beginning, which is really good. And that includes not, of course, for me, gender, but race and global location. And so there's always been a pushback in this institution that reflects the disciplinary growing edges about, if we're international, how reflective are we of that international? And how do we get persons and voices in communities? I was saying that some of these hot spots are places where there have been money, South Africa, South Korea. I'm trying to think of the other sites that you somewhat see this. And so how do you get persons into an international conversation when resources aren't as available as they have been to the U.S. and European context? And I think that probably reflects a challenge that has been discussed for religious studies and theology, Christian theology specifically, is awareness of the global change in location of the voices in Christian theology is moving significantly to other hemispheres than have been the case for the last couple centuries, and what kinds of changes that's going to, you know, affect. So I think, you know, when I think about growing edges, certainly thinking more about the international and global place and diversity of voices, and the difficulties of negotiating some of that. A second one that's related, that certainly has come up in some of the discussions so far, is because the discipline has emerged has been most actively engaged in an academic setting in Christian theological institutions, this book really hasn't looked at some of the interreligious or other religious traditions' engagement of questions that are related or are specifically practical theology. So you can look in the last 10 years in academic discussions. There have been sessions at the American Academy of Religion on exactly that question, that are across religious traditions and inviting people in other religious traditions besides Christianity to think about issues in related to practical theology. And even that is debated about, you know, is theology a term that is in and of itself something that's been, restricted and defined to the Christian tradition? And so even that is an interesting question. So those are some of the growing edges for the discipline, I think, to sustain its, you know, mm-hmm. intellectual life, but to continue to be interested in the broader voices, and certainly to think past and beyond this pretty, one of the chapters is on that Christocentric history that mm-hmm. the discipline reflects. Mm-hmm. Another one I can throw in there.
Sure.
Well, another thing that's been happening that I was alluding to at the very beginning is, I do think people in the so-called discipline have to keep listening to what's happening outside. I do think there's a real interest in engaging the daily across disciplines. And so I do think there needs to be an attention to what's happening that's interesting in other areas of the curriculum that reflects things we've been interested in, or that we might contribute to, or we might learn from, whether that's in the social sciences, or whether that's in changes in New Testament studies where material culture mm-hmm. is suddenly of an interest. Well, isn't that interesting? You know, material culture is really interesting for those New Testament scholars. Well, is that just a coincidence? You know, so how, because mm-hmm. I think there is some, you know, other things going on that it's easy to get to lose attention to and not ask questions about and learn from.
Mm-hmm. Just one more question that I want to ask. And this has to do with making a connection between the section we've just been talking about, which is, you know, the practical theology as discipline, and then the first section of the book, which was practical theology as an activity of faith. In the introduction to the volume, you mentioned that practical theology is, quote, that discipline most concerned with mediating and integrating knowledge within theological education and between seminary, congregation, and wider society, unquote. So I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about the ways that you see practical theology as a discipline and practical theology as a way of life talking to one another.
Yes. I think practical theology is a discipline. I would not want to make this claim for every person, but I would think that one of the intents for most scholars is that they want to have their work always in close connection with part one. You know, if it doesn't have either as its grounding or as its purpose, and the grounding would be that, you know, that it's close to religious practices in their rich variety, and as a purpose, some people in practical theology think of practical theology as a discipline as having a transformative or constructive agenda for enriching these practices and communities. And so there is kind of a feedback loop or a loop between, there needs to be between part one and part four. Practical theology as a discipline has had a deep interest in this kind of mediational role. It's from the quote that you had, or integrative role, or bringing things together. I just heard someone I was talking to in a practical theological area use the, I'm going to just borrow from her, some disciplines are analytic or they take apart, and some disciplines put together. And really, practical theology is more the latter. And so, you know, it doesn't rest easy with just analyzing. It wants to come back and offer something that reaches across and does more with the topic. That's another thing I was going to say, is that it seems to me that practical theology as a discipline, part four, just continues to, as it has as its subject matter, questions that cannot and will not be reduced to a singular disciplinary response or answer or an analysis. And in other words, I mean, I just look at my own work. If you're going to do work on, let's just take the contemporary cultural context of children's lives, both nationally and globally, and some of the real serious questions faced by children, That's a question or a topical area or a subject matter that needs to be integrated from the get-go. You need some historical understanding. If you're going to do it in a religious context, you know that scriptural resources have shaped regard for children in powerful and sometimes destructive ways or positive ways. So you're invited into a discussion that requires this move of this reconnective mediating move. And that's also true, you know, so there's topics like children there's just a huge array of those kinds of topics. And then there's also questions of the theological curriculum that practical theology seems more interested in, like formation, like integration. Again, things that require reaching outside itself to other resources to address fully and adequately. Mm-hmm. So that's not really answering the question of the relationship between part one and two, but more going to that kind of mediating interdisciplinary role that practical theology seems to find itself caught up in.
Well, throw on an extra question from the side of practical theology as a way of life. I mean, how how do the people who are not in the discipline, who are in the congregations or in the specific contexts, how do they benefit from what's going on in practical theology as a discipline? I mean, what's the loop there? I mean, how are they integrated into this?
I can think immediately, and this won't be exhaustive, but just a couple spots. Mm-hmm. One is at the curricular spot when I think about this book. You know, if in some ways this book has an influence, not on religious studies and the broader study of religion, but on the theological educational curriculum, one hope is to make a difference in how people are formed to engage faith communities, whether as religious leaders in congregations or in a variety of other ways. And I do think that practical theology as a discipline, part four, really hopes to continue to think hard about what happens in the educational context. And it's interesting, if you're a biblical scholar or if you're a New Testament scholar in a theological curriculum, you have those questions, but they often are not foregrounded. They're more foregrounded if you're teaching in a narrowly defined practical theology area that constantly in the classroom, you have to think towards practice. And you have to think towards ministry leadership practice, but something like worship is a practice that is engaged in across, you know, leadership and laity. And so people who, you know, teach these courses, maybe even more so than history courses or scripture courses, have to constantly think about what's going to be the impact in the lives of people on the ground. So I think teaching is one, and certainly research is another. People find their home at a variety of places of influence. And sort of to my surprise, I really love the academy. The hardest challenge I have sometimes is, you know, taking and doing adult education out of my scholarship. But I do think that the books that are written from the discipline do hope often to reach a wider public. And so if I look over my own scholarly career, there are certain times when I've really chosen, okay, now I'm really going to see if I can write a book readable by and useful within religious communities, or by persons invested in religion who aren't in a religious community but would like to think about how religion is influencing their lives, like my book on women and mothers and families. So that's not really written for a congregation, but it's got a sense of you can't think about work and family issues without bumping up into religious mores that shape how we design family life. And so my sense is with both that book, and I'm going to go speak in a congregation about the one book I've done that's most, it's on spirituality and family life. And so I do think that there's a hope that practical theologians really do have this public, broader public, that they hope they reach through their research. And maybe the most gratifying, I am pleased that a doctoral student said this book, Companion will be of use. But the most very gratifying, I guess is how I should put it, emails that I get are people that have read also A Mother or In the Midst of Chaos, the book on mother or on spirituality that I've done, where they really are, I can see my life in a new way and I'm really empowered or freed or new things I can conceive of because of having, you know, encountered some of the work you've done. And so that may be a couple places where it comes, you know, part four gets back to part one. The tension for scholars in part four is how to really, you know, who do your audience, you know, people in other disciplines really are often clear their audience are their other academics. But I think people in the discipline of practical theology are always a little torn and have to sometimes justify a publication record that is aimed towards a very, what looks to the academy as a fairly odd audience of, you know, that's not the typical audience. I do think other disciplines, not in theology and religion, but beyond, are, you know, deliberating on what's the purpose of university scholarship. So we're not alone in that. And there are divergence of opinion even among university scholars. There is no end, but good scholarship, or that is really a false, you know, a dichotomy. The end should be greater social impact. So, you know, I think this is not unique to the discipline, but it does get magnified in the discipline for sure.
Well, thank you. This has been a very, for me, it was an enlightening book and an enlightening conversation. And I appreciate your being willing to talk about practical theology with me.
Well, thank you. It was wonderful on my side, too.
Great.
It's fun to be sparked to think new things.
Great.
So, yeah.
Again, I've been talking with Bonnie Miller McLemore, E. Rhodes and Leona B. Carpenter Professor of Pastoral Theology and Counseling, about the Wiley-Blackwell Companion to Practical Theology, which she edited and for which she provided an introduction. If you have any comments about this conversation, just browse to the homepage of the Vanderbilt Divinity Library and click on the Contact Us link at the bottom of the page. We look forward to hearing from you, and thanks for listening.